Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome back to In the Pink, the podcast with me, Natalie Pinkham. Thank you for your feedback on Tubes. I knew you'd love it. Well, because I loved it and you can't help but love him, can you? I mean, what a great bloke. He's kind of always been there, hasn't he, in the background. Growing up with him on TV, you kind of feel like he's one of your pals that you could, I shouldn't say go for a beer with, because he is now teetotal. I just loved his honesty and his openness about his battle with alcoholism. You know, he's very brave, actually, to say the things he did. So thank you, Tubes. You know, I know you love the word legend, but you are one. There is no doubt. Okay, sticking with the theme of football, I'm going to introduce my next guest, who is Mr. Lee Dixon, fans' favourite for both Arsenal and England, part of, arguably, the best back four to have ever played in the Premier League. That's a bold statement, I know, but I'm sticking by it. Let me know if you disagree. Post-football, he turned his hand to punditry, and to great effect. He is very good at talking about the beautiful game. Let's see if he is as good talking on the podcast. I think you'll find he is. He's the thinking man's footballer, Mr. Lee Dixon. Lee Dixon, how very lovely to be joined by you this morning here in sunny Barnes. Do you know, I'm going to be honest.
Oh, no.
You are obviously a revered footballer, a hero to many, but that's not why I wanted you to do the podcast.
Look at my face. I've got my face is all wrinkly because I don't know what you're going to say next.
No, I just think you're going to have good chat.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say you're going to reveal something about myself I didn't know.
No. It's not an expose, don't worry about that.
Thanks.
No, but I've seen your pundit work and I've seen you at charity events and I just sense that you're going to have some good stories for me. You're going to have a good old natter.
Mm.
No pressure, but please make me laugh.
I'm very, very pressurised right now, actually. I think I'm quite a chatty person. And obviously doing what I do on a regular basis, as in talking quite a lot, although sometimes the adverts get in the way on ITV, but that's another thing. I do love talking about football. I love having a laugh. I think that's one of the things that certainly playing football and being in a dressing room, it's part of the whole process. You have to be able to join in. You have to be able to be a guy in the dressing room that has something that the other guys are interested in. You know, straight away, dressing rooms are really... they're difficult environments to survive in, and you have to find a way of fitting in
right
when you first go into one. So, and
do you
I
mean
always,
in terms of a pecking order of like knowing your place and where you fit into the whole scheme of things? Is that why they're hard?
They're hard because of that, but they're also hard to find your it's probably same as going into any sort of work environment. You go in there, say you go into a school when you first go into school, you have to kind of. You go in, you're not too sure how to behave, you kind of, who's my mates? You're trying to find mates straight away. So in a football dressing room, it's the same thing. You kind of know these guys because you see them. When I moved from Stoke to Arsenal, I didn't know any of the Arsenal players as opposed to being mates or anything, but I knew them, you know, David O'Leary, Tony Adams, all these amazing, Kenny Sansom, all these amazing superstars that I'd look from, you know, the second division as it was then up at this... the golden chalice of the first division, and go, I can't play there. They're way above where I see myself as a player. So, and then all of a sudden, you know, literally on a Tuesday, I go into training at Stoke, and on the Wednesday, I'm driving down to sign for Arsenal. I mean, how scary is that? I'd only ever been to London once, and that was to watch an England game with my mates when I was at college on a big bus. Got absolutely hammered with about 15 pints of lager on the way down, and I'm not a drinker anyway. Well, I am a bit, but not a big drinker.
I was going to say 15 pints is all right. Yeah. Well done.
No, I shared a few. I tipped a few out the side of the coach. But then going down to London, it was just, you know, going down to sign for Arsenal. I mean, I was 22 years of age and 23. I'd just turned 23. I'd got a six-month-old, my first child, Josh. You know, that's scary in itself.
Young, that is young to be a dad.
Yeah. And well, I got my big move. I signed for Stoke when I was at, you know, I was at Bury. Stoke came in for me. I was like, that's it. Get married, because that's what we do up north. You know, not a lot else to do. So we go and get married. And so I got married, had a kid at 6 months. So that was a massive thing. I was playing for a big club then. And I thought I'd found my position, second division, Stoke, decent, mid-table. I thought,
you seriously didn't have bigger ambitions than that?
Well, as a kid growing up, you want to play for England and you want to do all the big stuff. But, you know, being a pro footballer for me was the ultimate. And then it was like, then I got released after a year of being a pro footballer. I signed pro for Burnley when I was 18. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I was literally walking down the street. Nobody knew who I was. I still lived in Cheshire. And I used to drive to Burnley every day to play. And I'd walk around Stile Village and Wimslow and stuff like that, and bumping into people going, oh, huh, what do you do for a living? And, you know, hoping they'd say, weirdo, I'm a nurse or a whatever. And they could say, you're going to ask me now? I'm a professional footballer. That was like 2 days after a sign. That was like my pinnacle. So, and then after a year, John Bond came in, manager of Burnley, new manager, and after two games said to me, you'll never play for me again, you're not good enough. And I was like, hang on a minute, but this is what I do. And he released me with no club, go and find a club. He wasn't particularly nice to me, and, you know, he's not with us, God bless his soul now, but he was not a particularly nice guy to deal with, and he just discarded me into the wasteland of discarded footballers, as if it was just a normal thing. And I was devastated. And I was, how am I going to get over this? Because I haven't got a club now. And the only two clubs that came in for me was Crewe Alexander and Chester City. And Crewe were mid-table fourth division, as it was then, League Two as it is now. And Chester were bottom of the nine, they were 92nd in the league. They were bottom of the fourth division. And I was like, what? That's nearly not a footballer anymore. What do I do if I go to 93? What happens then? So anyway, in the end, John McGrath, bless him, who was manager of Chester, signed me as their right back in position 92. And I was in the fourth division all of a sudden. And then it was a process of trying to be the best I could, and then the following year, I was only there a year. Following year, Bury came in for me within the third division. I was like, oh, going up. But I had a ceiling. The ceiling was, I can't play in the first division. That's big boy stuff. So then I went to Burnley. Then I went to Stoke, and I thought, that's it. Wow. And Stoke were decent side. You know, they were, Mick Mills was a manager who was one of my heroes because he was a fullback and played a million times for England and educated me on how to defend a little bit. Was still a bit bomb forward, didn't really do a lot of defending, but I learned a lot under Mick Mills. And then next minute, 18 months later, as I said, Arsenal came in. It was like, Mick Mills, he called me in the office and he says, we've had a call. And I was like, okay. You know, I thought, because there was a few rumours around that somebody was going to come in for me. I was playing pretty well at Stoke, won player of the year as a fullback, I was scoring goals from there as well. And he goes, yeah, we've had a call, you're gonna, he said, brace yourself. And I thought he was going to say something like Coventry or something, no disrespect to Coventry, but it wasn't. And he said, we've accepted a bid from Arsenal. And literally the blood drained from my head, went all the way down to my feet. and I started shaking, and I was so terrified. I literally wanted to say to him, I don't want to go. But I thought, oh my God, I can't play for Arsenal. Ridiculous. And skip 15 years, and I guess this was my driver as a player. I played for Arsenal for 14 and a half years in the end. But every single day, and this is not a lie, you might not believe me, every single day I was expecting someone to, I'm leaning over and tapping Natalie on the shoulder, I know you can't see this, going, tapping on the shoulder and going, only kidding, you've got to go back to Bury or Burnley now, off you go. And it was like one of them, I was like, God, they picked me again, let's just carry on playing.
You know, I find this really hard to believe because you seem like such a confident person, a calm confidence about you, but clearly not. You obviously doubted your ability, maybe because of that rejection early doors, has stayed with you.
No, absolutely. I think that, albeit it was devastating at the time, it was probably, from a learning point of view about myself, the best thing. Because I wanted to prove, you know, John Bond wrong. Mm. He went in and he disrupted a really lovely family club, Burnley, threw all the young players out, brought all his experienced older guys in, Jerry Gow, Tommy Hutchinson, players, Kevin Reeves, and he kind of ruined the club, and he's not been thanked since about that.
That's awful. I mean, one person can have that much of an impact.
Oh, you ask people at
Burnley.
A grim
legacy.
You ask people around Burnley what he did to the place. I'm probably fortunate to get out.
Yeah,
and then give me that, right, I'm going to prove him wrong, and I'd like to think I did. We played him in the, he was manager of Shrewsbury a few years later, and Arsenal drew him in the FA Cup.
Yeah,
and it was the best day of my life because I was coming off after the warm up down the tunnel, and he was walking the other way, and he just looked at me, and I stared at him in the eyes, and he kind of just walked past me and didn't say anything. I thought, oh, that'll do me. I think I've proved him wrong.
I'm sure you have.
I don't know what the question was at the start of that.
Me neither.
Something about.
All the while, though, you're a City fan.
Yeah. Well, born in Manchester, my dad played for City in the 50s. He was a goalkeeper, played for the reserves. He never made the first team. Bert Trautman was goalkeeper then, who was a legend, and my dad was kind of understudy. So he was a pro for 3 years. We were a City blue family. Went to the Kippax every week, standing on the terrace in and all of that lot. And the funny thing was, the one team that we hated more than Manchester United when we used to go watch games was Arsenal. And so when I signed for Arsenal, all my mates who are City fans went, can't sign for them. Remember, we hate them. And I was like, yeah, I know, but it's changed a bit now. And now I'm obsessed with the club that I played for, and I always want them to beat City, which is my City fans, mates, are not very happy about that.
But they must have supported you through your time at Arsenal. Did they switch allegiance?
No, they didn't.
Support Arsenal?
No, they didn't. They didn't switch allegiance, and I always used to get a message before we played City going, come on, because City weren't very good then, and we were pretty good. You know, go easy on us. And then they were out of the league for a while, you know, got relegated and stuff like that. But I still support them a little bit, but Arsenal, and you know, once you get into a club like that, it's just such an amazing club to be part of. And I never forget, and I've told this story a million times, so I'll tell it really quickly, but it's on the 89 video and stuff like that. But I turned.
Don't say video. You're really showing.
Did you say video?
Yeah, you said video.
The Betamax, no? Oh my God, did I say video? Can't believe it. Don't tell my kids. Whatever it is, DVD,
no,
Blu-ray,
no,
what was it?
Oh God, just a film, okay?
It's a film, yeah, it's a film.
Brilliant film, by the way. We'll talk more of that later. But anyway, yes.
What was I saying? So that's what
you
I
said.
Do,
it was a good story, but it's a short story, which I'm told by my husband is always the way. Good story. It's a short story, Pinky. Keep it sweet.
Oh, I can't even remember what I was saying now. Whatever.
You said, I've told a story a million times, I'll tell it again.
Oh, yes, I got it. See, that's what happens at 55.
There you go.
It comes back. is that I turned... When I signed for Arsenal, I went down to the Watford Gap service station with Mick Mills. And all the way down there, Mick Mills was telling me, you've made it now. This is Arsenal. You do, and Stoke had offered... I was on £350 a week at Stoke. And they'd offer me £500 a week to sign a new contract, so which was great, but then Arsenal came in for me, so I was kind of like, what sort of money, you know, I didn't have an agent, Mick Mills was driving down in the car, driving me down, and I said, what sort of money? I don't know what to say to him when I get there. Because George Graham was an imposing character without him knowing him, just seeing him from a distance. So I knew I was going to...
He had that reputation even then, didn't he?
Yeah. I knew I was going to be in the lion's den a little bit. Mm. And then And he went, oh, you've made it. So that's for... And he just went, that's for £1,000 a week. That's the kind of money your first division players will be on. So I went, okay. So I had that figure in my head. So we get to Watford Gap service station, get out of the car. George Graham is in his Daimler Sovereign in the driver's seat. And my dad had a Jag. So that familiar leather smell when you get in a car that makes me feel a little bit car sick. Yeah, I opened the car door and got in the passenger seat and thought, feel a bit sick. So, and there he is in his Arsenal blazer, tie, immaculate white shirt, almost cutting his neck. It was so sharp, the collar. And I just went, oh God, I just want to die. Please be nice to me. And he just looked at me and he went, wow, what an opportunity you've got now. I'm going to build a team around young, hungry guys like you. Sold the club to me, didn't have to, because I was going to go, whatever. And then he went, great to have you on board, and starts to get out of the car. And I went, excuse me, Mr. Graham, how do we do the contract thing? You know, what happens now? And he went, sort of went a bit weird. Want to talk about money? And I went, got family at home, 6-month-old. But, and I knew the property prices down in London were a lot higher, but I didn't know how high. And I sold my, in the end, I sold my house for £35,000 in Stoke and bought the equivalent house in Hertfordshire, same size and everything, for £170,000. Wow. So I was literally brassic. My dad was paying me mortgage and everything when I first moved, because it was the only place that I could settle down was in near the training ground. But George said to me, right, well, what do you want then? And I said, and I had this £1,000 in my head, and I went, £1,000 a week. And he literally just went, are you kidding me? I've got internationals not on that money. I said, you money orientated? Is that what you're all about? I've got you wrong. And I was like, no, but and it got out of the car. He got out of the car and walked, and that was it.
Oh my God.
And Mick Mills come out, and he came out, he goes, what the hell have you said to him? I said, I told him what you told me to ask for.
Yeah.
And he got out of the car and said, the deal's off. I started crying and he goes, get in the car. He said, that's it, it's done. So I got in the car, drove all the way back to Stoke, crying my eyes out, a 23-year-old man in the car crying. I got my wife and 6-month-old baby back in Stoke, sort of oblivious to all this. I get back home, she went, how did it go? I went, not great. Deal's off. So I was devastated. So I then phoned Mick up that night and I said, what do I do? He goes, give him a ring, here's his number, call him up and say you'll come down to see him tomorrow on the train. Try and resurrect it, because he's not having you. And I was like, phoned him up. George went, come down, we'll have another chat. So I got the train down to London, cab to the front of Highbury, Marble Halls. Have you been in there?
Mm-mm.
Have you
not walked? Oh, yeah, Highbury, yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Marble Halls.
Obviously ages ago, but...
Yeah, because I'm very old.
Yeah.
Walked up the marble steps, going, Herbert Chapman's looking straight at me. Mm. I've got this ridiculous, horrible... Marks and Spencer green and blue jumper. I'll never forget it. I think my daughter's still got it. And I looked at Herbert Chapman and I went, I'm not leaving here until I sign. So I walked straight to his office, walked in, and I said, I'll sign for 500 a week, whatever. And he went, he said, I thought that might work. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go halves with you, so I'll give you 750. And I went, I signed on the dotted line, and that was the start of my... relationship with George Graham, which was one of massive education, lessons every day, hit you with a stick, make you really work for you. But the money side of things with him was always really difficult, because he had the club at heart in that respect. He was tight as anything, wage structure, so you couldn't get a penny out of him. You had to win something or do something, which I think is the right way.
Yeah.
It's gone the flip side now, and it's you know, they get too much too soon, but old school it was like, if you win something, come back, knock on my door, give you a new contract, and he would, but very small.
And so what year was that?
88.
It's not that long ago.
No.
I mean, Or is that just me getting old?
It's you getting old.
In the Pink is sponsored by Bose, who've been perfecting the art of sound so that you can listen in unrivaled comfort. The new Bose Noise Cancelling 700s take it to a whole other level, so you'll always hear exactly what you want, no matter where you are. Also, be heard like never before with their unrivaled 4-microphone system, which isolates your voice whilst cancelling the noise around you. Pretty cool, huh? Always stay connected with Bose's first-of-its-kind augmented reality function that will change the way you think about travel, exercise and learning. And never be caught out because they have an excellent 20 hours of battery life. They come in black and silver, so you can work them around your style, your little fashionistas. And you can treat your ears with the Bose Noise Cancelling 700s. It's a sound experience like no other. Now, back to the interview. How quickly did you bed in with that group of players? Because the defence Arsenal at that time, stuff of legends. I remember chatting to some of my mates at work who were like, oh yeah, if Arsenal went 1-0 up then, that was it, you know, because you're never going to get through that defence. How quickly did you surround yourself by these great names like Tony Adams, Martin Keown, Winterburn? You obviously knew Steve Bould already because you'd come down with him, hadn't you?
Yeah, well, he signed 6 months after me, but it was a very quick learning curve to actually bed into the way that Arsenal played at the time. And George was very strict. There was a way of playing. It was completely alien to me because I was a fullback that showed I was pretty quick, and as a fullback that showed a winger down the line, because that's why I was being educated. And then all of a sudden, George, on the first day of training, it was at the indoor training centre at Highbury, and it was freezing cold because I signed in the February. So it was like cold outside, we couldn't train because the pitches were frozen. Go inside and we do this like little session, and they kept shouting in to me. In his Scottish voice. I go to sleep sometimes at night having nightmares about him shouting at me still to this day, because he was going in, and I was going, in what? Why are you saying that? So I said to Dave Rocastle, bless him, who again is not with us, and I said to him, what's he keep saying in for? What's that? I don't know what that means. And he went, oh, it's inside. You have to show everybody inside so you don't get beat down the outside. So me playing on the right, I could not let anyone go down the wing. I had to show him inside the middle of the pitch because that's how we played. It was where our strength was. Don't get beat on the outside. Show everybody inside. And I was like, and it was so alien to me to try and do that, because it was just natural to go show him down the line. No, and he used to basically fine you if you got beat down the outside. He said, right, I'm going to fine. Do not let people get crosses in. You show him inside. You show him inside. In. It was like, and then he'd metaphorically whack you with a stick if you didn't do what he said. And that's his way of coaching. Mm. But his coaching sessions on the pitch were so intense, and you had to pick it up quickly. It's a little bit like, I'm married to a beautiful lady in my life now called Yolanda, who's a dancer, and she can relate to that picking up. It's like picking up steps, and I can't dance to save my life, but you know, a choreographer, here's your steps and you have to learn it straight away, and if you don't, you're out. And it was basically George Graham's choreography was show inside, press the ball. There was triggers to go and press the ball. You had to learn them. It was a little bit like NFL playbook. This is what happens when the ball's there, you're there, you do. It's very regimented. And if you didn't learn it, you know, fortunately, I'd, you know, unlike my dancing, I'm quite quick at learning patterns on a football pitch. And I guess that's why I then go on to do what I do now, which is talking about those patterns and trying to not teach, I hate that word, like teach people.
It is type of teaching.
But it's only what I know, so it's not gospel, and there's loads of different ways of doing it.
And it's your interpretation of it.
Correct,
but, yeah. But
it's like the ability to show you or what I know that's in my head, when I see a pattern, I go, I would do this, is what I think you should do. I had success doing it this way. Then if somebody understands that at home and a light bulb goes off and goes, oh, I get that now, why that player might have done that or something. I guess that's what I learned under George. It was understanding them, that pattern on the pitch. So
And the discipline that he brought, presumably, correct. Just like impose. Oh yeah, you see, that facial expression says it all, because it's like you still remember that discipline even now.
Yeah,
but it's now ingrained in you because of it.
See,
which is a good thing, you know. Like,
yeah, and patterns. It is ingrained, and I miss a little bit that in my life now, and I mean that because I was with him 2 weeks ago at the Tottenham game, and we did a charity box. 15 people, you know, paid money to charity to watch a game with me and George Graham, and I hosted it, and George was the jewel in the crown, because I knew, even at, you know, he's 70 odd, even at now, he's so passionate about the game, and he recognises the game's moved on, and he's a bit old school, but the game hasn't changed, and it's about how many you put in one end and how many you keep out at the other. That'll never change. And until you do both reasonably well, you won't win anything. You can, Man City are brilliant going forward, Liverpool are brilliant going forward, but they still both know what to do without the ball. And his big thing was get that balance right. And he was a little bit more the defensive side, make sure you don't give anything away, and then nick one at the other end, 1-0 to the Arsenal. Yeah. Arsene is the complete flip of that. He's attacking, great-looking football, brilliant, open, freestyle, gunplay type, but he couldn't coach a back four as long as he's got two ears and a nose.
So, but how difficult was that then for you to adjust to that style of management?
Easiest thing ever, because
he left you to your own devices.
Yeah, because when he's a hugely intelligent man, Arsene, and came in and went, why? He knew us anyway before. He always tells the story. He says, I knew you lot, you know, because he's a football nutcase. He watches videos. He'll watch videos of Arsenal for years and years. So when he came from Grand Passé, he knew all about us. Mm. He said to me, I'm a bit surprised that you're actually a better footballer than I thought. I thought you were just like, you know,
brick wall.
Yeah, a load of grow bags at the back going, like, just winning the ball.
I heard he actually said you're better looking in the flesh as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you're testament to that. I can see you looking at me now going, no, he's wrong.
I tell you what, though, growing up, I was bloody scared of the back four at Arsenal. Keown and Tony Adams, they were
scary,
yeah,
aren't they?
Whoa.
Yeah. Nigel Winterburn as well. Not a looker.
Lovely. No. But do you know what? Actually, watching the film, before I watched 89, I thought, I don't remember. I'm too young to remember any of this. Mm. And as I watched the film, it's amazing how much comes back.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, it must have been, 10, 11?
Oh, thanks. Thanks for really making
No,
feel
no,
alive.
But seriously, I do now, having watched it,
yeah.
It did stop. I was like, yeah, I remember that. I remember that moment. I remember those faces. I remember the buzz about them. I mean, the footage looks so old, doesn't it, now, when you look back at it?
Well, we,
and you see how far telly's come.
I think the beauty about 89 was the fact that that's what we do. We take everybody back to that time with the music, with the, you know, the pictures of the politicians, the way that the music ties in with everything. And everybody,
the fashion.
You know what it's like? Music gets everybody nostalgic. Hear something, you go, oh, I remember that, and then all of a sudden the game's on and you can go back to where you were.
Just started boarding school. I remember that, yeah, because I remember the music. Yeah
Wow.
All girls boarding school, scary place.
Don't go there.
But you're distracted now, aren't you?
Yeah, I just got boarding school. How terrible.
I know, well.
How cruel is that for your parents?
Yeah, do you know what, it's funny. I mean, this is a different discussion, because we've just been trying to work out where to send our kids to school, and it's a bloody hard decision. My mum and dad sent me there, and I'm really close to my mum and dad.
Yeah.
But my mum and dad sent me there because my mum had been to the same school, and she absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And there weren't any decent local schools where we lived.
Yeah.
And so she thought, well, she knew I loved sport, and it was a really sporty school. And she sent me there, but God, I was so homesick. And even now I go, Mum, how could you do that? And she cries even now thinking about it. She goes, I thought I was doing the right thing for you guys. But
I think I'm kind of right in the middle of, you know, doing the right thing for your kids, and then I go back to, what's the point of having kids if you send them away? Because you're missing all that fun
and also how can you have an influence on them if you're not with them?
Yeah, you're kind of giving it to somebody.
You're relying on a stranger.
Yeah,
and there was a few weirdos at my boarding school. Anyway, look, we digress. Back to Arsenal, back to your education on the football pitch. Mm. See what I did there? Nice little segue. But you grew up at Arsenal, really, didn't you?
Yeah.
Because you were kind of wet behind the ears. Mm. I know you were 23 when you got there, which, you know, by massively. Today's standards is quite old, but you were still young, you know, you're still naive.
Absolutely. I mean, when I look back, and I have this argument, I say, discussion with my kids now and again, and about 4 or 5 years ago, my son's 31 now. He's a strength and conditioning coach for the FA, works with the Lionesses.
That's
and
amazing.
Some of the... Yeah, he's brilliant. He retired when he was 10 from football because he just went, don't want to play anymore because don't really like football, and I just get put under a load of pressure because people come and watch and they go, are you Lee Dixon's son? Oh, you're not very good, are you? Or, you know, well, you should be better than this. Why are you not playing right back? And why? And he just went, I'm not playing anymore. So, which was really sad. And I, at the time, I didn't want to push him. I didn't want to go, forget all that. You know, you've got the drive. Because it's unfair. And I don't think he was talented enough anyway to have the strength to go through that. Mm. So I said, as long as you play sports and do other sports, that's fine. You just got to play sports. Sports really important in my life. And I believe it's the best thing for you. And he went, and he played all the sports. Da, da, da. And then when he was 18, he started playing at university again and loved football again, fell in love with it, did a sports science degree, and then got into the fitness side of football and loves it, and he's massively passionate about his job and he's really good at it, and he's educated me on the new style of fitness and all the new stuff that's going on now, which is great for me because when I go on TV, you know, I don't want to be the dinosaur that's always going, oh, in my day, so I've got that because I lived it, but I've also got the, in my day we did this, but now they're doing that, you know, because I'm not in the dressing room, so I've got the best, I'm in his dressing room and listening to what he comes out of that. So I've
kind of tapping into... How amazing for your son to educate you, and, you know, it's come full circle.
I always say it's wrong, but deeply I'm
taking
it all in.
But it's great that he's helping keep you relevant in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely, and he's... You know, some of the stuff he's coming out with and talking about, I'm like, wow, God, I'd have been so much a better player if I could have done that. Because there's loads of stuff that, you know, to be fair, I hit Arsene Wenger at the perfect time because I was 32 when he came. Mm. And I was just sort of starting to go, oh, a bit niggly, my knees a bit, this is that. And he came in and revolutionised English football in the way that we... ate, trained, stretched, and it was kind of like wow. And he said, look, if you do this, you know, you'll play for George. To be fair to him, said I'll find a way of playing that makes my back four play till they're all 35, and I played till I was 38. So there was a bit of George Graham in there, and there was also a bit of Arsene coming in and giving me new techniques to keep my body going because the brain. When Arsene came, we won the double in 98. I literally could play the game with my eyes closed. It was I'd got all that experience from George, knew how to defend. I got my three mates alongside me who were almost unbeatable. Dave Seaman behind me, almost unbeatable unless the ball went over his head from somebody, me.
Your own goal against Coventry.
Ronaldinho.
Listen.
Naeem.
I tell you what, that was a cracking goal.
Thanks.
It's just a shame it was into your own net.
Yeah, well, the anniversary was the other week, so you probably saw it on YouTube. I always tell people, they always take the mickey out on Twitter, oh, yeah, I've seen your goal. I said, keep watching it, because I get a pound every time someone watches that video. Obviously don't, but people go, really? So they think I get royalties for that goal, so I can keep watching it, it's great. Arsene hit me at the perfect time, and a 98 double. The game was so easy, it was embarrassing. I was like, all right, I know, I get the ball, right, okay. Got my mates alongside me, we're not going to concede any goals. And then when I look up and I've got the ball, and Arsene's going, just go and play, you know, none of that restriction, go and play. And I look up and I've got Patrick Vieira coming short in midfield, and then I've got Dennis Bergkamp waiting.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Giving at me going, give it to my feet. And then I've got Ray Parlour outside me running straight down the line. And then I've got the second striker, Wrighty might be there. Or Thierry Henry might
what
be.
A team.
You could have played right back. It was so easy. And I played my best football at that moment, 98 yeah. to 2002, was double winning side as well. But Lauren had just started taking over and I retired in 2002. I was 38 and I was tired. My knee was gone and I was kind of... But from 98 to sort of 2000, those 2 years, the game was absolutely the easiest I've ever known it.
What a time to be alive. Do you know what? I think you've answered my next question, because there must have been at some point a sense that, I don't want to say professional jealousy, but a sense that, God, if only you'd played in the modern era, you'd have earned so much more money and you'd be kicking back and, you know, living a life.
And not doing podcasts.
And not doing... This is for the love of conversation.
Absolutely, yeah.
But seriously, there must be part of you that's like, I can't believe the sort of money these kids are on these days. Yeah. But what you've just described, you can't put a price tag on that. I mean, I can't think you would get that level of passion and love for the game from many people in 2019. It feels more inhibited now. Yeah. It's just a different game, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I think I get asked this a lot and people go, oh, bet you wish you'd play now because of the money. And I go, yeah, it'd be great. And I'll tell you a funny story in a second. But the money side of things is you can always look elsewhere and be envious. And all the guys who played in 70s and were looking at us going lucky. Because I had a lovely living out of playing football for Arsenal, but the memory side of it far outweighs that. Now, I think it's flipped the other way. The money side of it outweighs the memories. Some people, the guys who are winning stuff, will say differently. You know, the Liverpool and Man City's and that, but they still get in the money as well. Mm. But I would not swap one day to play now, not one single day, because I had a decent living. But I had the best. We were free. We could go down to the Bank of Friendship and have a game of darts with the locals on a Tuesday after training.
This is Tuesday Club.
Tuesday Club. It might be a Wednesday as well. No, I'm joking. The Tuesday Club.
But this was a boozy kind of boys' club thing that you just would never be able to get away with these days.
Correct. And it's also been massively exaggerated over the years that every Tuesday we went out and run riot around London and did this, that. Not the case. Once a month, maybe, if that, once every 5 weeks, we'd go, if we had a week off, we'd go for a game of darts with a few locals, a few pints of Guinness, go down TGI Fridays in Covent Garden, have some ribs or whatever, and then some of the lads would go out and... It's been well documented about who the ones that went out. Tony Adams, obviously, in his book, he tells stories about those Tuesdays. But it was exaggerated. But you could go out, team spirit, you could do that. You could also mix with the fans after the game, you know, be signing autographs outside the ground. Stuff like that, that when you look back on it, I love those moments because I was that kid asking for the autograph. There's no access to players anymore. You know, the access that they get now is from a distance, and it's on Twitter, and it's And, you know, social media has its place. But, I mean, if I was playing now, I wouldn't be on social media at all, because it's distracting, it's intrusive, it's great tool to use for lots of positives. But from a player's point of view, if I said, I think there's too many negatives to it, my concentration needed to be, certainly from my point of view, because I wasn't the most skillful player in the world with my feet, but my head and how I played the game was.
And you read the game.
So, but I had to work very hard at that, and I had to work very hard at my fitness and be. And so I don't want that distraction, you know. I want to be concentrated.
What you say about social media, because you don't ever get the level of intimacy that you would do, directness with the fans, and yet they've got access to you, and you're vulnerable to criticism. You're exposed to it, but not in a kind of human way.
No.
You're not looking at someone in their eyes and talking about the game afterwards.
No.
You're just under attack, and that must be potentially soul destroying for a lot of players. These days. Along with Bose, In the Pink is sponsored by Tag Heuer, Swiss avant-garde since 1860. Excellence, precision and elegance. Their timepieces are designed for those who love challenges, which is a great fit for this podcast because most of the guests share that sentiment.
I want to ask you about the racist problem that we have at the moment. From your perspective as a white player playing in a team with other black players, but also having, there've always been racist undertones. We can't deny that.
No.
Do you think it's worse, or do you think a light's been shone on it now, and so we feel it's worse because we're just talking about it more?
Yeah, I think, you know, the social media side of things highlights everything, the good stuff, the bad stuff. I don't know whether I honestly don't know. Because I'm not playing now. Because on the pitch, you hear a lot of stuff. When I was playing, you do hear, I say a lot of stuff. That's wrong. That's, it'd be wrong of me to say that, because when you ask somebody to think backwards, they get all the times they've heard stuff and they kind of cram it all in one. Oh yeah, there was loads of racism. There's lots of times in games where you wouldn't hear anything, but there was certainly a racist undertones. We've seen all the footage. We've seen, you know, all the stuff that John Barnes went through, to name one. And so there's always been a racist undertone to society. So the fact that it's now, is it any worse at football now? I don't know, because I think the social media just highlights everything's amplified. And you see everything, you hear everything. If it was like that back when I was playing, it might have been exactly the same. I don't know. Mm. We've certainly not got any better. So that means it's got worse in my book, because there's no improvement in that respect.
I remember going to one of the last games at Highbury when Arsenal played Chelsea, and we were with the Chelsea away fans at that point. I was with three other girls. One of them is black. And there was such an uncomfortable undercurrent that we just left.
Yeah.
And it was really depressing. I think what happened was Thierry Henry scored, and I think John Terry then equalised.
Right.
And there was massive racist abuse directed at Thierry Henry. And my friend Eleanor, who's black, said, I don't want to be here. I'm a black woman. I do not want to be in this. Yeah. And we left. And I thought, how can we not watch the sport we love because of that? And that must have been, well, how long ago would that have been? That would have, when did they stop playing at Highbury?
2006, they went into the new stadium.
Right, so, yeah, that would have been about 2005. So, God, that's just so depressing. So, what I want to ask you then is, what advice do you give the young crop of players that are exposed to it now? You know, obviously we've been hearing about Raheem Sterling against Bulgaria, and this sort of collective decision whether they leave the pitch en masse. Is that the answer?
Well, it depends how bad it gets, and how bad is bad. You know,
anything is bad enough, isn't it?
Absolutely. But if you say that the first incident in a game, soon as something is said or heard or whatever, everybody walks off the pitch, I don't think that's workable.
They've had too many examples of this, haven't they? Haven't they just got to take a stand now?
Well, there has to be something, but the argument against that is, well, you're giving in to the racists. It should be the thing is with football crowds is this is a bit It's a society problem because if something happens in a crowd, there's hundreds of people know who the guys are or girls or whoever it is who know who the racist comments are coming from. They know, but because they get into that mob mentality, there's a kind of protective thing around them that they go, well, it's all right, we're in a group. And I was at a game recently, and I won't say who or where I was, but I was in a box, and I was looking at the fans, and it was, there was black guys in the crowd, and there was things being said. I couldn't hear exactly what said, but it wasn't that the racist undertone that I was missing. It was just I was looking at the people, the aggression and the faces of these people in the crowd. It made me feel sick. I was like, what does football do to people to make that okay for that person to behave in that way? That's the bit. And whether it's, and that's not that, it could be two white guys, you know, opposite sides, that tribal sort of that's always been there in football, which makes it so exciting because you've got us against them in that, you know, one team against the other and wearing your colours, and I get all that. But I've shouted at players and, you know, for passing the ball out and making mistakes, and you can feel the sort of passion in yourself coming up, but it's never led to then wanting to fight or hurt somebody because of a game that's going on. That's the bit that's a society thing, because it just makes it a place that people with real issues in their life, for whatever the reasons, get a place to vent that. And that's the bit we've got to try and work out. And I'm not necessarily saying it's a racist thing, but there's an element of that as well in it.
So 22 caps for England. Did you feel fulfilled?
Yeah,
did that feel fair, a fair amount of caps, or should you have had more?
One was good enough for me. I'd have settled for one.
Do you know what? I'm feeling all the way through this podcast, you had very low expectations for yourself. What's this about?
I don't know. I'm still trying to
would have a field day with this.
I'm 55. I'm still trying to work it out. I always put it down to it being my driver. I don't know where that's come from. I guess I've been at Arsenal and surrounded by such brilliant footballers, and maybe not. I'll tell the story about Tony Adams, the last game that we played together. Him turning round to me, and ball got knocked over the top. I ran round the back. Tony was out of position, swept up, knocked it back to the keeper. And as I'm running back to the halfway line, he turned to me, and as I ran past him, he goes, and I'm starting to get goosebumps as I say this. He said to me, "Do you know what, Dicko? You're one hell of a fullback." And I went, "Wow. That to me was better than a medal," because I looked at him as my captain. He was my captain the whole of my career at Arsenal, and for him to turn around, it took him 15 years to say it, mind. But he eventually got there and said, "You're one hell of a fullback." And I went, "Wow!" And that was 2002, in our last season playing together. We both retired the same year, and I just went, "Wow, that's incredible that he said that to me." And it fulfilled all the little gaps about my ability to keep playing at a club like that. And I was like, yeah. And I didn't feel like that all the time, but there was definitely moments during my career when I went, "Oh, I don't know, I keep getting picked every week." George Graham put the team sheet up, and it's like, "Number two, Dixon." 14 years that happened. So I do give myself credit now, but I still remember that feeling of going, "I've got to keep working. I can't let up, because if I let up, someone's..." And we signed 3-4 fullbacks, right backs over my career there, and I saw them all off, and I was kind of like, "Right, there's another one gone." And then all of a sudden Oleg Lushny's coming from, you know, from the Ukraine, and I was like, "Oh God, there's another one I've got. He's going to find me out. This is the time." And it just made me train harder, made me play harder, and I was very thankful, as I said, to that, you know, top 3 inches in my head that enabled me to be in the right position most of the time. And as a defender, and we'll see that. We see it now in the modern fullback, the modern defender, etc. The lack of ability, I don't know if that's the right... What I had was an ability to be in the right place at the right time, and George gave me that. He taught me where to be. And I'm not sure that's being coached as much now, because the emphasis is on going forward, creating exciting football, which is brilliant to watch. I love watching it, but it also, the England game the other night frustrated me against Kosovo, because we conceded three goals, sloppy goals that Gareth won't be happy with, the team won't be happy with, the defenders won't be happy with. But how much does it really hurt? You know, in the social media, in the media this week, it's been, what great game, you know, 5-3. I heard on TalkSport, I'm going on about, I'd rather them win 5-3 than 2-0 or 1-0. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
But is that you as a defender saying that, do you think?
Yeah. And I, you know, on ITV the other night, I said they were talking about, you know, Raheem Sterling and going forward and creating this stuff. And do you think this is going to, Sancho, is he going to be in the team? I don't know. I'm like, don't care. I really didn't care at that moment, because all I was concentrating on was like, we've just conceded three goals against Kosovo. And so that mentality that I got from George is still in me. And when I watch football now and I look at, and Gareth, listen, I played against Gareth and I worked with him on ITV. He's everything that I want in an England manager, because I just think his passion and what he's done to the England team is just brilliant. He never opens his mouth without something hugely intelligent and thought-provoking comes out of it. It's just brilliant. I think he's an astonishing England manager. I really love listening to him. I love watching his teams. But he'll be frustrated by getting the balance right. The balance in the England team right now, for me, is not quite right. The midfield, the defence, it's a little bit tipped to this expansive, brilliant football we're playing with. And they can play that. You know, it's like when I was at Arsenal, we could play that game and still be tight at the back. Mm. So you can still have that.
Yeah, you don't have to have one without the other, do you?
No.
They're not mutually exclusive.
No, the forward bit is exceptional. Mm. And the talent we've got there, and you can have that in a team, but you have to have the link, and the link is the key. The defence on its own can't defend on its own. You have to have that link, and the link is the midfield. So when people having a go at the defence, conceded three goals, they all came about from mistakes and sloppy play, and the midfield area is that link between good attack and being able to keep the ball out of the net, which is half of the game.
Given how your brain works, as we've already discussed, and how you do actually like to teach, because you even use that word when you're being a pundit, why aren't you a coach? Why didn't you go and become Gareth's defence coach for England? You might sort all this out.
I don't think he's got my number.
But would you? I mean, in all seriousness, why haven't you gone into coaching? You've thought about it, haven't you?
I have, yeah. No, when I stopped playing, I was doing some TV work, and I have to tell you, and I don't know why this has come up right now, and maybe it's because you're a really good interviewer, I don't know, but you've tapped into something, I can feel it inside now, why I didn't go into coaching, and I've never really allowed myself to feel what it is, and it taps into what I was talking about before, about somebody's going to tap me on the shoulder and go, right, your time, you've won the competition, you get your game, now you've got to leave the pitch because you're not good enough. It's tapping into that. It's like, even though I had an amazing career and won loads of stuff, and I felt as if I'd not understood my position as a fullback, there was definitely an element of fear in the next step of going into coaching and going, I've got to do my badges. I've got to go out there and expose myself again and go, well, this is what I believe about coaching, and then do the coaching badges. There was a fear about that. And I've not really allowed myself to talk about that before until this moment. So it's kind of like there's a definite fear attached to it. And I was doing TV. And although TV is a hugely scary thing to do, as you know, and when that light goes on, when you first start doing it, you don't want to be there, you want to be somewhere else. And it takes a while to get used to, and some people never get used to that, and that's why they you're flitting and out of doing being a pundit or a TV presenter, and then you never see them again. I've managed to find a way of getting my point of view over, without it, the fear of, is people listening to this going, he doesn't know what he's talking about? Because that's always in me, I guess. And so that coaching side of things, I was always, it's easy to do the TV. And I'm quite good at the TV, so I'll just do that. And I love the TV, don't get me wrong. But there's definitely a part of me now when I look at the coaches on Saturday and during the week, and I go, oh, I could do that. I could, and I do some mentoring for some young fullbacks, and I talk about stuff one-on-one and do clips on videos on a laptop and talk about their game. And I love that. I love sharing my fullback knowledge with a fullback, a young kid. I really enjoy that bit. And I do a little bit of stuff over in America with a friend of mine runs a football team in Santa Barbara, and he gets me to go along, and I love talking to the kids, and I really like, but I also like my out of football place. And I think if you're a coach, the fear of giving myself to the game again and going 24/7, there we go, I've been out the game long enough and enjoy TV enough for it to satisfy. But every now and again I do go, oh yeah, can I just pop in one day a week, and I'd love to do that, just pop into a club and go, right, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do fullbacks today, and I'm going to take six of your young lads and just do a, you know, tactics board and a, what are you thinking here, and da-da-da, do that, and then leave and not have the pressure. I don't miss the pressure of performing. And I think
there's no doubt a hell of a lot of pressure comes with coaching, but I think you'd be really good at it. I really do. The way you communicate and the way you make me understand the game, like your descriptions earlier, I can just see it. You're just painting a picture for me with your words, which is, you know, obviously is important as a pundit as well. But it feels like, well, I'd say there's a lot of people out there that would argue that is more intimidating to go in front of the nation and do what you do. So I think you've conquered that.
Yeah.
But clearly it's a lack of self-belief as opposed to ambition, because you've always been ambitious.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still working on why. But having said that, then I now think where I am, sitting in a little cinema with you in West London, and thinking, what am I going to do this afternoon? I've got some free time, or I'm going to do something, or I'm going to go ride my bike with my mate who's sitting over there looking at me going, should we go and ride our bike? Or going to go and play golf with my son. Or so I've got free time. I'm working Saturday, Sunday at two games for NBC. I can't tell you how excited about going to Norwich I am on tomorrow. And then Sunday I'm at Watford Arsenal. I'm buzzing. I feel as if I'm going to play.
It's a good life.
Yeah. I've got a great life. And next week I've got some PLP work to do, and then that's one day, and then I'm going to play golf then, I'm going to ride my bike then, I'm going to do some stuff for charity on the Thursday, and then so if I was coaching, I'm fully immersed and totally in football again. And
it's definitely addictive. You know, you look at Mourinho, who's like, can you imagine being married to him right now, pacing around, just desperate to get back to it?
No.
I mean, you once you're in it, you're fully...
Yeah. I can't imagine me being married to Jose Mourinho. But, that's exactly right. You have to throw yourself in. And every manager that I know that trusts me enough to talk to me about the game has said, have you ever thought about it? And then every one of them to a man has said, don't do it, because you have to be addicted to it. You have to go into that addictive world of stress related enjoyment. Why would you want to do that?
Well, you do see how much they age in a very short space of time. Feels like me at the moment, when I look back at those Facebook memories, they go, this was you 5 years ago before you had children. Okay, that's never 5 years ago. 15, maybe. Jesus, have I aged that much? Okay, let's just quick word on Gareth Southgate, because you're obviously a fan of his. Will England hang on to him? Do you think that a Premier League club will lure him away? Would a Premier League club be the right place for him? Because it feels to me that England environment is perfectly suited to him. I don't know him the way you do, but
no,
what do you think?
I when I was working with him at ITV, he was just basically a coach / manager waiting to happen. You know, it was just a matter of time. He went to the under-21s, and then he's progressed brilliantly to the first team. And whether club management will suit him, I don't know. I think he's absolutely cut out to do what he's doing right now. I think his communication skills have been, as well as the way he set the team up and talks about the team and what he did at the World Cup, all of that sort of stuff. But his communication skills with everybody is a massive asset he's got to be able to... You can see how he talks to, you know, the TV people and the nation about political issues and stuff that he talks about. And so when you're a player, if you've got skills like that and then he comes into a dressing room, I would just listen to him anyway because I think, well, he said all those really sensible things over there, so he must... And he knows the game. You know, he's a really good player, Gareth. Very good centre-back. And I think he knows the game. And to be able, I would listen to him, you know, even though I think I know the game, I'll go, well, I don't know it all. What, you tell me something. I'd want to play for him. Mm. And I always look at managers and go, would I want to play for him? What's he got? What's he got that can drive me, to motivate me, to fill in those big gaps I've talked about my self-confidence on a pitch? And what could he do that I would go, yeah, I'll take that and it'll make me a better player? He's got all that in my book.
Mm. He's actually a classic case of someone that's brilliantly reinvented himself as a player, because I think that's got to be the hardest thing you do when you retire, is to know where to go next. And yeah, it's taken him a while, hasn't it? Because yeah, his legacy would be missing a penalty, but now it's, you know, he's changed the course of his destiny by reinventing himself, which, yeah. I mean, how hard is that to do, to understand where you are meant to be ultimately with your life? Because you retire so young, really, yeah, you know, yeah, being no, compared no, to any other industry.
Yeah. Well, it seemed when I retired, I was 38, it seemed the right thing for me to do was to go in, to carry on doing the TV stuff I was doing, because I was reasonably good at it. I could string a sentence together that made sense in my head. And people like friends of mine, like Adrian Childs, who I worked with, he was the, you know, one of the best people I worked with, because he was a football fan, is a football fan, and he has big holes in his understanding of what's happening on the pitch. But as a fan, he's got that passion. So when I used to work with him Match Day too, I'd say something to him and he'd kind of go, and I'd see his eyebrows go, I don't understand, doesn't compute. And then I'd go, I realise now that maybe what I've said... Is so somebody at home looking like Adrian is at the telly going, don't understand. Mm. So when a light bulb went off in his head, I knew that everybody at home, or a lot of people at home, had got it as well. Mm. So he was my litmus paper of what I'm saying. So I would keep talking until the brow went smooth and the light bulb went off, and then I went, oh, right, I've finished now. And so he was brilliant. I've told him that, but he didn't realise it at the time. And he was like, right, I need to work with Adrian all the time, because, and obviously then you work with different presenters, and Mark Pugacz is a brilliant presenter. I love working with him because he's really passionate about football, but he gives you a different question and a different way of talking to him, because you're kind of talking to the presenter, although you're projecting back home. Mm. If you can talk to the presenter and project back home at the same time, then you're doing your bit. If you just... talking to, so that's why sometimes working with Gary Lineker when I first did Match of the Day and stuff, he knows the answer intimately. Mm. So I didn't always get from him, I didn't always get anything back from him, because I was like, he knows this. He's kind of like, so you end up maybe trying to talk to everybody. Is it just a different way of doing it?
Yeah, because you're not putting it into layman's terms for him, because he doesn't need you to. And that's that in it can potentially alienate your audience, because they don't.
Yeah, but I don't
in what you're discussing.
I don't necessarily like that layman's terms, because there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of people at home that know more about football than I do.
Yeah, but they just haven't played to the level you have.
Exactly. So that's the difference. If you're explaining something, is only my point of view about a situation. It's not going, you know, pundits who go out there and go, that's wrong, he did that. You have to understand, and this is one thing somebody told me, you know, give somebody at home a bit of information they couldn't possibly know. Now, if they've played football, they could know that. Mm. But if I've given them the information, but then said, from my point of view, as a Premier League player in a dressing room, something happened, or that's sharing something that they couldn't possibly know. Mm. So that's gold dust to the people at home. And so that you've got to try and find a way of doing that, but it's not dumbing it down. And that's why working for NBC has been brilliant for me, because I talk about the game differently. And it's not dumbing it down, because you're talking to an American audience, lots of expats who know the game and watch a lot of football, but you're also explaining stuff in a different way. You know, and some of the words that I might use wouldn't work in America. I have to change it because I just presume they know what, the winger's got, you know, the fullback's struggling, the winger's got him on a piece of toast. And I might say that to somebody here and they go,
I don't know what you mean.
No, you need to go to America and then right. I can say it in a different way. But it means, you know, certain things you'd explain it to them in a different way. And it's a brilliant... I'm talking to somebody who knows all about this, because you, as a presenter and a broadcaster and a very good one at that, even though it's your podcast, I have to say that. It's like you make people at ease and you find a way of pulling information out of people in a very special way. And that's your talent.
Makes me sound manipulative, though, doesn't
no,
it?
No, it's not. No, because you talk to somebody else, another footballer, another racing driver or whatever it is, and understand that you can't just ask that question because you know the guy and you're intimately involved in his career, and you go, can't ask, and I don't know motor racing enough to suggest the characters, but you can't ask so-and-so a certain question the same you would ask and you want the same information. Mm. So it's not manipulative, it's brilliant broadcasting. Right. So well done, you.
Thank you very much.
But I do have to pick you up on something.
Oh, go on, yeah, go on.
This has been bothering me for a while. I don't want to end the podcast without mentioning it.
Oh, shit, what's he going to say?
So we talked about feet before because we had a photograph taken and size of feet. I'm not mentioning size of feet because that's fine. You've got lovely feet, size 6, whatever. But I don't know if you've done it on purpose, but your laces are really bothering me. Because you've laced one up crisscross and the other ones overlap.
Oh my God, I didn't even notice
that. That's really bothering me.
Oh my God, have you got some sort of OCD thing?
You know, we're talking about your son going to school and he's 4 years of age.
But I have as well.
You were going on about your son before.
Yeah.
And he was going to his school and you'd done his tie up. And I tried to zoom in on his tie because you've not done a bad job. I've got a thing about ties as well. They have to go up to the top button. Yeah. You can't see any of the top of the collar. And it has to be a certain type of tie knot. And also laces. If you do your laces up...
Right, can I just say something in my defence? These are my Adidas Stan Smiths. And they came like this. I just took them out of the box and put them on. I haven't noticed... Oh,
what
shaking your head.
What excuse is that?
All right, so I've got to change up.
As they come out the box...
Which one should I do then? Crisscross or...
Don't care, just as long as they're the same. When they come out of the box, did you go, no, the laces are different?
No, didn't notice.
Or did you go, I've got... 2 kids under the age of 4, my life's a mess.
Yeah. Not a mess, but too busy to notice laces.
Yeah.
I tell you what, it is interesting about the tie thing, because he's 4. Why are they making him wear a tie, a proper tie?
Absolutely.
Every morning I'm trying to do this bloody tie. He goes, Mum, you're hurry up, Mummy. And I'm going, like sweating in the morning. This is like 7 a.m. This is too much.
It's about discipline. It's about understanding. It's about who you are.
George
and
Graham
who
coming
you represent.
Out on you again.
Absolutely. And wearing a tie at 4 years of age does not do him any harm whatsoever, unless you do it up like you did it. Get one of those on a piece of elastic and then it'll be the same every day.
That's what I'm hoping. Thank you so much for your time. It's lovely to talk to you. Could go on and on.
Yeah.
I think we have actually gone on and on quite a lot.
Edit.
I certainly didn't need to make any notes or create any questions for Lee Dixon, because that was always going to be just a lovely, free-flowing chat. He's so easy to talk to. So thank you, Lee. And I found it really moving, actually, that he wanted to... perhaps still does be a coach, because he's got such a good footballing brain. But obviously that comes across really well as a pundit, so long may that continue. Thank you, Lee, for your time and your conversation. Okay, let us have your feedback on this podcast and all the other ones in the series so far, and who you'd like me to talk to next. We've got a few cool ones coming up, so stay tuned for those. And stay tuned to find out how you could win some of those very snazzy Bose 700 headphones, the noise cancelling type. Just don't cancel the noise of In the Pink, okay? Keep listening. Rate, review, subscribe. Thank you for your company.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.